Donovan Scoter, interviewing for the Oklahoma Living Legends. We're in the Tulsa City County Library, February 24, 1972. We're interviewing Mr. Leonard Swoverland, who was the executive director of the Tulsa Community Chest from 1947 to 67. After his retirement, he served 2 years as a consultant for the Community Chest.
Thank you, Ms. Van Scoter. I am indeed happy to tell a little bit about the organization of the Tulsa Community Chest and something about its leadership in the number of volunteers and the amount of money raised. In 1923, the Chamber of Commerce of Tulsa had many business and professional leaders making complaints to them that something must be done to bring order out of the chaos of the numerous solicitations in the name of charity. There was no assurance, or little at that time, that the solicitations were necessary, and little known about any budgeting process, and whether the goals were proper or not was not known or made public. So this strong feeling that existed resulted in the Tulsa Chamber of Commerce, who was then headed by J. Burr Gibbons, a man and leader in the advertising field, appointed a committee to study the problem, and this resulted in the recommendation that a community chest be organized. In 1924, the Tulsa Community Chest was organized, and they were fortunate enough to draw on the top leadership of the community. That was not only true at that time, but it's been true over the years since. D.W. Moffat, who was the vice president of the Mid-Continent Petroleum Corporation, was elected as the first president of the Community Chest. The campaign chairman was the well-known Ralph Talbot, a theater owner, and the goal for the then 12 or 13 agencies set for 1 year operation was $238,895. And I think it's a credit to the leadership back in 1924 that they were able to exceed that goal by more than $8,000. The number of volunteers in that drive, according to the little records that we were able to discover, show about 200 to 300 people working. Now, when that is contrasted with the last community chest goal, also known as Tulsa's United Drive, in the fall of 1971, the goal was $2,300,000, and that mark was exceeded by more than $48,000. The number of volunteer workers in the most recent chest drive was around 4,000 people. The number of subscribers in the 1971 fall drive was in excess of 78,000 Tulsans. Now, when that's compared with the 8,000 or 9,000 contributors of 1924, it is very obvious that the chest and United Drive has made a very real progress and success. It was my privilege for over 20 years to serve as the executive, and my great pleasure has been to work with the top leaders of this community over those years. The heads of oil companies and banks and many other businesses and professions have served the Tulsa Community Chest as they have a number of other institutions and civic groups. I think it might be to name a few of these leaders. They are truly the pioneers, and many of them rugged individualists of this great Southwest. A number of them are known, of course, nationwide, and not a few, of course, statewide, and all are very prominent or have been prominent citizens of this great and beautiful city of Tulsa. John Rogers, a lawyer and a leader in many fields on integration and all civic projects, former president of Community Chest and campaign chairman, former president of the Chamber of Commerce, and a leader in all fields of endeavor in his profession as well as civic improvements, is truly one of Tulsa's outstanding citizens. R. Otis McClinic, who was board chairman of the First National Bank for many years, now chairman emeritus, served back in the 37, 38 years, 1937-1938. And the late John E. Mabee, who's the Mabee Foundation, has given many millions of dollars to benefit this community. Was my pleasure to work with him over the years, as well as with the late W.G. Skelly, head of his own oil company over the years. Richard K. Lane, known to countless thousands as Dick Lane, president of the Public Service Company of Oklahoma, was both president and served as campaign chairman when I first came to Tulsa in 1947. That year, Mr. Warren, W.K. Warren, whose family is the donor of the St. Francis Hospital, some $30 million hospital institution, was president. So I have worked with many of these top business people and leaders, as I said, of Tulsa, including Clarence Wright, who was board chairman of the Sunray Oil Company, and R.W. McDowell, who was the president of the Sunray DX Oil Company. Russell Hunt, one of the top officials of the First National Bank, and you have Millard, Marvin Millard of the National Bank of Tulsa, board chairman of that bank. It has been my real pleasure to have worked with all of these people that I have named, plus many, many more. Now, over in the north side of Tulsa, the late Reverend Ben Hill headed the entire north side solicitation, and on another year Henry C. Whitlow, a very prominent educator still with the Tulsa public school system, also was the chairman of the north side solicitation, as well as Ed Goodwin on another year, the publisher of the Oklahoma Eagle. Now, I've been rambling along here for some little time, Miss Van Scoter. I wonder if you have any other angles or questions you'd like to have me bring out on the Tulsa community chest before we switch maybe to another angle on this particular subject.
Yes, on these gentlemen that you've been talking about, are any of them particularly outstanding in a way that would be easy to work with or particularly difficult to work with? Did they enliven things with their sense of humor or some interesting incidents that you would recall working with these men?
Well, I hadn't reflected very much on that particular question. For the most part, I think one term would cover their personality pretty much in the business and civic life of Tulsa. Rugged individualist. Now, to the southwest, that has a special connotation. To someone back east, maybe on the west coast or up north, they would view that meaning a little differently. Well, these men, I could tell one incident on the late Dick Lane, who was for many, many years, as I reported, president of the Public Service Company of Oklahoma, was a campaign chairman when I came here in 1947. When I got in town, after a day or so of getting acquainted with the office, I contacted Mr. Lane, and I told him that I was now in town, I'd like to see him, and at his time that was convenient, I'd be up and make a call. He said, "Well, I'm very busy now." He said, "In a couple of days, I'll have a little time for you." Well, that kind of finished that conversation. The city that I had come from in northern Indiana was much smaller than Tulsa, but I'd been in the same line of work as the executive director of that community chest and also the Council of Social Agencies. And I was used to, when I'm having people respond rather quickly when I made an appeal, because I never bothered the people unless I had something of some importance. Well, I waited a number of days on Mr. Lane. I got no call, so I put in another call to him. And he's one of the most efficient operators I've ever seen. He said, "Leonard, I told you that I'm a busy man now, and especially busy." And he said, "When I get a first opportunity, I'm going to call you." Well, I read the reading on the wall, and or the writing on the wall, so I didn't bother him anymore. And a few days later, he did call me. And then he started, within 2 days after he made the initial contact, I did with him, he had the entire top leadership lined up. Well, I just couldn't believe that, because usually that stretches out over a period of several weeks, to say the least. Now there's, and I learned something from him that, I needed to kind of stay out of his road. Others needed prodding. Some the leaders are just so busy with their own businesses, and many of them have businesses outside the United States, some real interests and so on, where they'd spend considerable time. So many of them I did prod, and it was, I'd say no two persons were exactly alike, and that's pretty normal, I guess. But this city has seen the marks here of all these men I mentioned, and countless dozens of more that I could name here. We had, I think, two interesting situations. With a father-son combination, our Otis McClenic, as I previously mentioned, was the head of the First National Bank of Tulsa for many, many years, and then his son, who was in the oil business, Mac McClenic, is known as F.G., Frank G. McClenic, became interested in the bank, and has since succeeded his father as president, and I am currently as board chairman of the First National Bank and Trust Company of Tulsa. Well, Our Otis McClinic was the campaign chairman of the CHESS back in 1940. And his son, Frank, or Mac, as many of us call him, became the campaign chairman of Tulsa's United Drive in 1958. So here's the case of the son following his father eventually in the banking business, and both of them heading up a big civic organization, the Tulsa Community Chest. One other I think will be of interest to many people, and that is that Virgil S. Tilley, Sr., was who was in the accounting business, partner in the firm, was the budget chairman of the Community Chest when I arrived in 1947. 2 years later, Mr. Tilley, Sr. became the campaign chairman, and the following year he became the president of the Community Chest. Now his son, Virgil S. Tilley, Jr., followed also in his father's footsteps and served on the budget committee, was budget chairman. He became campaign chairman in 1967 and CHESS president in 1968. Now, Ms. Van Scoter, I'm going to pause here and see if you have maybe another angle or question you'd like to raise.
What would you say motivates these men to accept a responsibility like this? What do you suppose is their thinking? Why would they want to contribute their time and their effort in an effort like this?
Well, that's a very good question. Certainly is appropriate and in order, and it's a little hard to answer fully. I recall one campaign chairman who remarked many times during the year he was campaigning before various groups, large and small. He said, well, some of you may wonder what I'm getting out of this. Of course, everybody knows that there's no salary paid to these campaign chairmen or president or the officers or the board members. It's just the staff, and the staff small, even now with this last campaign, the $2,300,000 plus being raised, the office staff, the paid staff, numbers less than 12 people the year around. So there has to be something in this that attracts volunteers, these busy business and professional people. And not only men, I've been naming men here. Now, we've had no lady as yet. That was before this women's lib day, but women have headed the suburban division where they would have as many as 2,000 workers, and we've had just top leadership year after year in that big suburban division where they do residential solicitation from house to house. Some years they did it on a little more select basis. When I first came here, there was no house to house solicitation. But now they raise a lot of money and make a lot of contacts and inform a lot of people through this procedure, which is time-consuming and wears out a lot of shoe leather. But getting back to specifically to your question, this one volunteer chairman said, well, I think that my business and what we got out of it and out of this community, that I owe something to the community, and about the least I can do is to pay a little rent for the space I occupy, and that rent is my time thinking of other people and helping the less fortunate and the underprivileged and the boys and girls with character building, and the Salvation Army is one of the 46 agencies, and American Red Cross tied in here, and the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls, and here's the YMCA and the YWCA, and the various other agencies serving various sections of the community by location, but citywide, many of the services, clinics and so on. Cancer clinic at St. John's Hospital has been included for many, many years. The Heart Association is a member of the American Heart Association of the Tulsa Community Chest and has been about all of the years that I was serving, still is. So I think these men and women who spend not only their time, which is very valuable to the business and professional people, but they're giving many of them sizable contributions and spending a lot of wear and tear on their shoes and cars. So I would say it's the inner feeling. They have to have a good heart. Tough as they seem, we talk about them being rugged individualists. There's something in the human heart here. I think when you reach a certain place, most people, and as I mentioned, these heads of oil companies and big banks and little banks, smaller banks and so on, and all the other businesses, they just want to share, and they want to pay a little rent for the space they occupy. Now, do you have another question, or does that kind of answer what you had in mind?
Yes, it does, but you keep mentioning the term rugged individualist.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear your definition of that and how the people of Tulsa would define that.
Well, that's a toughie. I don't know how the people of Tulsa will define it. I'm a Hoosier. Came here from Indiana, as I remarked previously. To me, when I arrived here in Tulsa, well, I might go back a minute. I didn't seek this job when the executive director of Tulsa Community Chest was leaving to go to Kansas City, to Missouri, to head up that big chest to Kansas City. He called me one day and told me he was leaving, and he said, Leonard, why don't you put in your application for this job down here? His name was Ed Moyer. And I said, Ed, I'm satisfied where I am. We own our home here. And I said, I'm in both the chest and council as the executive, and we started some new agencies up here. One was the Urban League, and another was a nursing service with registered nurses called Visiting Nurses. And I said, we have a church connection and all. But he said, well, you can get a free trip down here. We'll pay your expenses. And why don't you look over the city and let them look you over? Well, I said, since you put it that way, maybe we'll take a couple of days off from down. So my wife and I drove down, and we were greatly surprised to see Tulsa, the clean city that it was, and the tall, shiny buildings, and we didn't have anything in that part of Indiana, northern part of Indiana, where I lived, to equal the beauty of Tulsa. And they made an offer after they looked me over, and we looked the city over, and I agreed to come after talking it over with my wife. Well, my wife started crying after I told her that I had telephoned back to Indiana and told him that to look for another man, that I had just agreed to take on this position here in Tulsa. And I thought, well, it's too bad that she'll have to make all new friends, and we'll start from scratch on that basis. And I hadn't been here only about a year, or we hadn't been here about a year, and I was contacted by to see if I'd be interested in the position at Miami, Florida. Well, that nice warm state of Florida, and no snow, generally speaking, at least down there, and a good salary offer and all. And so I said to my wife, this being 1 year after we'd come here, I said, well, now I got a contact. I said I couldn't leave immediately, but I'd have to give, proper notice. I said, you shouldn't leave really short of 3 years service. That's what the professionals kind of require to be, in order nationwide. Otherwise, you're considered to be out of line. Well, when I told her that, she broke down and cried again. She didn't want to leave. She was in love with the city, and to show how much we love it now, we went ahead and bought some crypts and a mausoleum, and so looks like we plan to stay here for the rest of our natural life and even beyond on that. Now, you ask for definition. I went to all around Robinson's barn here on definition about rugged individualism. These men that I met, they were, for the most part, pretty tough to me. I was the old country boy and came from a big family and 9 children, and we were poor and still are today. But anyway, down here, when these fellas, they said something, you could depend on their word, they meant it. They put much money in, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions, as I mentioned, but the Warren family, putting in $30 million. That's something that struck me now. Of course, that's been done since we came here, rather recently, in fact. But I looked at some monuments around town here in the way of buildings, and number of well-to-do people who were letting go of their money and putting up something for somebody else. Maybe Foundation, I mentioned, giving away many millions. There were others giving away sizable amounts, but somebody gave a $500,000 building for the Red Shield Club of the Salvation Army, one man giving $500,000. Well, that struck me right down my heart, and I've never seen anything like it. And I say rugged individualists. They came up, many of them were poor. They came here, I've heard the late Maurice Sennett of the Oklahoma Tire and Supply Company say, when he landed in New York City off of the boat from the old country, he had $5 in his pocket. Well, he became a millionaire and died just recently here. But he worked in the community chest, headed the big divisions and liberal contributor. And that story could be told over, of course, dozens and dozens of times. I could name individuals who have contributed sizable sums either for church, hospital, or community agencies, and setting up foundations for agencies so that they'd have something when the rainy weather comes and that sort of thing. Now, I don't know if that is an answer that satisfies you, but these men, to look at them, they look in Tulsa like other people, but under their coat and under their shirt, I think there's something down inside that causes them to just react differently than people do a lot of places, because many places, many cities have wealthy people. But there's something here about Tulsa that has always struck me as just being most unusual.
How about a specific example? Which particular person would you think of as an unusual example?
Well, I mentioned Sanditons, there are a number of brothers of Sanditons. Maurice Sanditon, who passed on a short time ago, and another brother died here this past year. He served on the budget committee. Now, the Sanditons, when you just have to be honest about it, they're worth a lot of money, millions. And when a man will come down to a budget committee and sit with 60 other people and spend several hours a day, and this budgeting runs for 4 or 5 weeks, and they meet 3 and 4 times a week. Now, for a man to leave his business that many times, now these are good Jewish friends of ours, and I could mention, and we'll... I could mention many on the budget committee who from these banks and oil companies, top people, and I have managed a number of other drives on a volunteer basis, no paying for it. I served with Dick Lane, whom I mentioned now several times. He was the general chairman of the campaign for the remodeling of St. John's Hospital a number of years back, and they set out to raise a few million dollars to put on the West Wing and to air condition St. John's Hospital. And Mr. Lane asked me to set up the campaign outline and to organize the mechanical aspects, all of the pledge cards and prospects, and make suggestions on leadership. He arranged, of course, the top leadership, but we had to have many hundreds of workers. This included many ladies as well as men. Now, that's an unusual situation, and Mr. Lane was asked also to go to Oklahoma City and manage a hospital drive in Oklahoma City, which he did, all for free. Well, you're spending weeks, maybe months, and this was also a Catholic hospital in Oklahoma City, he being a non-Catholic, prominent member of the First Presbyterian Church of Tulsa. Well, the bishop, the Catholic, Roman Catholic bishop of Oklahoma thought that was so unusual that he would head a drive in Tulsa and also out of the city, go over to Oklahoma City, and both of them were very successful. We raised in excess of $2 million here in Tulsa for St. John's Hospital to put in the air conditioning and put on that one wing. I also did assist at the University of Tulsa in managing their drive without any remuneration. They mailed me a check when the campaign was over, and I returned it and thanked them very much. But we raised in excess of $1 million, the first $1 million raised from individuals and companies in the university's history here. And since they got it through that campaign, many prominent people on their board who are still serving on the board and making very substantial contributions every year. So we set up something there that's in perpetuity, and this private school, which is privately supported for the most part, nearly all, if not all, is due to men like Dick Lane and many others that I could mention. And many of the men I have mentioned here as leading the leaders of the community chest have served or are still serving on the trustees board at the University of Tulsa. Now, do you have anything else?
Obviously, working with the chest, you've served with a number of agencies. Over these many years, surely there's one that stands out that has particularly touched your heart, that you really think that has been significant and it really means something to you. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the only danger of that is that I would be good for 1 hour and 90 minutes on this one. After having served as the executive of 40-some agencies for these many, many years, to pick out one and say that's the best would be like a mother with 12 children trying to choose one and neglecting the other 11. However, I can say this, that the one that appealed to me greatly and has some basis of proof on that is the Tulsa Recreation Center for the Physically Limited. It's located in 800 block on South Utica. And they serve some 700 handicapped people. And there's no charge for this service. The members do contribute not more than $2 a year in the way of a membership, but if they don't add the $2, they still are served. And I've watched that agency over the years, and I did make an approach to the agency executive, Mrs. Eileen Murdoch, and I told her if she could use another volunteer, I'd be happy to do so. Well, a little later, I received a letter that I had been elected to the board of directors of that recreation center for the handicapped people. And, well, I made fast time in getting over there and explained to her I appreciated the honor very much. And I said, look, I've had all these inside jobs and sitting down jobs around the table. I want to get where the action is. And I said, well, you tell your board that I appreciate it very much, this high honor. And indeed, it is a high honor to be a member of that board, or I would say, for that matter, any of the community chest agencies. I said, now, if you can give me a job where I can be active with the people, I'll consider that. Well, she said, how would you like to be a driver, go out and pick up some of these handicapped people and bring them to the center? They'll spend the day here, and you come along over about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and pick them up and take them back home in your car. And, well, I said, that sounds good, and I'll try it out. Well, I started about 2 years ago on that, shortly after I retired from the community chest. And I have that volunteer job today. And pays the greatest satisfaction of anything that I know of outside of church work. And I'd put it one along the side of the other. I've been teaching Sunday school class for, many years before I came to Tulsa. And have what used to be a middle-aged class, and of course after you teach for 25 years, why, for some reason they kind of get up in the senior citizens group. So I don't know what the average age group, probably 75 in that class now. I brag a little because I happen to be the youngest one in the class. Anyhow, I've taken on more church work since I retired. I did serve as two terms as chairman of the official board there at the University United Methodist Church, as it's now called. Getting back here to this recreation center, I pick up on passengers or members on two different days of the week, and they're not always the same people. Among those that I do pick up and take back home are three blind people, totally blind. One lady is 92 years of age plus. Dear heart, she's just a sweet lady. And I visited her when she's in the hospital and had prayer with her at the bedside. And her daughter is also a member of the recreation center. She is a heart patient. And while at the bowling alley, many of these people do bowl. The daughter doesn't bowl, but the 92-year-old blind woman does bowl. The daughter fell, and I had some little heart attack, and fell over and broke her shoulder. Of course, she was in the hospital quite a long time. I called on her at the hospital and tried to encourage her and had a short prayer. And so these folks are really closer than some of my own blood relatives to me. Another one blind person I pick up at the Methodist Manor. And she's a lovely person, and she bowls every week. And these folks, when they're not bowling, they're working on ceramics or in a choral group, and they have just professional people, pianists and singers. If we had time, I could name who just devote several days a week, the year round, except when they're closed for vacation or when the group is at camp 50 miles away out at the Lake Gibson. Some of the others, I pick up a man who's 91 plus, he'll soon be 92, and he has a brilliant mind. He recites poetry and entertains people who come out. They have visitors from Oklahoma State University and from the hospital. The nurses in training all come from Hillcrest Medical Center over there, and you can see when they watch these folks perform, tears in their eyes of these nurses and so on. It's a really very touching situation. I pick up a deaf girl. She's in her 20s, deaf and a mute, and Others, I pick up a man who is blind. He's about 60 years of age. One time he was very well to do. He told me that one time he had excess of $250,000. Well, today he's hardly able to get by. Can't take a taxi. That's the reason that he's picked up by volunteers. Can't afford a taxi. It's a tragic situation. Both of his eyes were shot out. He was shot in the stomach several times and has had many operations, and he has to have special elastic bands put around his stomach to hold him together. And well, he was sitting in a room in an apartment house and has a parakeet for company, and outside of the people that he's met there in the apartment who are very kind to him, he didn't have much to do. He gets talking books, but sitting there all day in your room gets pretty tiresome. So by picking him up and taking him down to the center, he can meet these friends who are blind and those who have sight, and he carries on conversations, and he can make some things there, leather goods, and he likes that very much. Well, that's just a little sampling, and with the others who are in wheelchairs, dozens of them, and across the board, Catholic sister is there, and she's one of the sweetest persons I ever met. Had a long conversation with her yesterday. And they have children. Special attention is given and programs for children. They have square dancing, and even people in wheelchairs participate in the square dancing, where some able-bodied person pushes them around to the music, and they do all the intricate patterns and so on. Well, you know, you could go all day on this, so that to me is some of the things I'm doing here as a retired person, all on a volunteer basis, and I'd say that I'm getting the greatest satisfaction of my entire life out of this program of working for this particular recreation center for the physically limited, and doing church work and Sunday school teaching.
In your 20 years as executive director, you must have had on your staff several different people, many dozens of people, I'm sure. Were there some that stayed with you for a long time, some long-term helpers?
Yes, and I'm happy to pay tribute and honor to Mrs. Bess Jones, who was with the chest at the time I came in 1947. She'd been there about 2 years previous to my coming. She still is employed as the assistant or associate executive director of the community chest. When I came here, she was in a clerical capacity, she was my personal secretary. And I hadn't been here only a few days until I realized she was too valuable to keep in that position, and so I did take it up with the executive committee and then later with the board, and got approval that she be made the assistant, officially the assistant executive director. And the service that she renders, she's a very smart person, almost bordering on, I'd say, as a brilliant person and student. After I got here, she worked out her master's degree by going to the University of Tulsa classes at the downtown college, and a few courses I think she took early in the morning on the campus. Now, she's a most unusual person. She can work with the top citizens, and she's also secretary to the oil division. Now, the oil division, and obviously, with the big corporations in that particular category, they do produce by far the greatest number of dollars. But on the other hand, the suburban division, where they go out and they get $1, $2, $5, $10, and on up to some of them rather sizable gifts, retired ladies, oftentimes widows, and some of them are very generous givers to the Tulsa Community Chest. Now, there is another employee who has been there as just about as long, I think 1 year less than Mrs. Jones, and that's Mrs. Maureen Carr, K-A-R-R, a little strange spelling. I talked with her today to get some additional information for this little reporting here, and now she's been there, that would make, 46 to 72, what is that, about 26 years. She's been almost 26 years with the Community Chest, and just was hardly off a day in all the years that she worked there. Now that's the most unusual person. Oh, we had others come in. I had a little Indian. And a very unusual person. A little Indian girl came in from Coweta. And her mother came in with her. She's Indian. Her mother was wearing, looked very much Indian, as you picture them in the old storybooks, you know, and sometimes on television and in the movies. She had a blanket around her shoulders, and a lovely person, I know. And here's this young girl, a little bit on the stocky side, and big smile, but little experience. Well, we started at a low salary, and she stayed at the YWCA residence, just a block away from the chest, and one of the chest agencies. And she went to a night school and became one of the best stenographers I've ever worked with. And she progressed to the point where pretty soon, you know, she had all kinds of invitations to go out, and finally did marry a man who has a very fine position. And she has a lovely family. I've seen the children and her and many times since she left the Community Chest. Now, the biggest turnover probably was in the, doubtless was in the public relations department. And we would get students from the University of Tulsa sometimes. They wanted some additional experience, men as well as women. We've had some top-notch PR persons, and one of them, very unusual, talented man. He was only with us about a year, and he made a connection with an oil company, and they've been sending him all over the country and out of the country to do stories and so on. So as I look back, you know, he can kind of say, well, you were something like a papa to some of these employees over the years. And of course, that's one of the satisfactions that will mean even more to me as time goes on, I guess.
Is there any other employee that you would like to tell about?
About my successor, do you want me to just mention him? Well, I haven't said anything about the man who succeeded me as yet. Howard Cotner was the executive of the Community Chest at Fargo, North Dakota. And about 8 years ago, our chest was growing to the place where we needed an additional assistant to me, and also one to succeed me upon my retirement. So the board appointed a committee to interview some applicants, and he was one of the applicants brought to Tulsa, and was chosen to become the associate executive director with the intent of being my successor if he proved out okay. Well, he did prove out 100%, and has a nice large family, and he is a graduate of the Ohio State University School of Social Work with a master's degree there. which is one of the few schools in the United States that features any courses in fundraising. And many of them, schools do have universities, colleges have schools of social work. So he has both the social work background and the professional approach on fundraising. But of course, everybody knows there's no good excuse for experience. They're just no good a substitute, really, for experience. And he's had a very successful period as the executive. Since I left, they've made the goal each year, so I'd say he's doing better than I did. Now, we had some tough years back in a number of years back when the so-called depression days were here upon us. But for the most part, by far the majority, I would say probably 70-80% of the time, the entire goal has been made. But we've increased the goal, of course, now maybe $1,800,000 since I first, since the chest was first started. And since I came here, the goal has been increased to about $1,700,000. I think the others, employees, they're very faithful, and compared with other comparable, with comparable work in other businesses and oil companies in particular, I'd say, and they are medium or on the low side so far as wages and salary is concerned.
You chuckled a little bit when you mentioned the depression years and the tough time you had then. Is there something that you'd like to bring out on that subject? Some unusual incident or what made it tough? Well, of course, the answer to that would be obvious, but some particular background in that would be interesting.
Well, quickly, you see, to get this goal up to where it is now, each year you'd be raising sometimes $100,000 or more in 1 year. And when I said the depressed days of Tulsa and depression, I don't mean the 1929 type. I mean where, for example, in the aerospace industry, if they weren't getting orders pretty much, say, from the government, you could lose on campaign contributions in that one industry, $100,000 or more overnight if they laid off several thousand people. And when they don't have work, they need to lay them off. It might be for a short time, but if it happened right around campaign time, now you just can't solicit people when they're not working. And they didn't know how long they'd be out, and that's just one example. So Tulsa's, like any other city, has had its good days and some days not quite so good. So for the most part, you just can't go along year after year and keep raising the goal substantially if employment doesn't hold up. Now, the organized labor has played a big part here in the last 10 years in particular, I would say, in the community chest. At one time, back in the early days, of course, that was not a big factor. They were getting the money in the chest from business professional people and some well-to-do people, and they were not going for the individual contributions. So you can see when you jump up to 78,000 contributors, that's a pretty broad and comprehensive approach to the John Q. citizen. So labor is playing a very important and a big part in the total campaign dollars. And if there is a recession where there is less employment by a number of thousands of people, then the results in that particular campaign are just bound to be considerably down.
You have a year-round staff that you mentioned, a small staff, but evidently there must be some particular time of the year that you make a special drive, that your drive really culminates. Would you kind of sketch the year and see how your schedule runs?
Well, of course, the year-round work is the... You finish one campaign at the end of October. The campaign proper starts about the latter part of September with big gifts and special solicitation gifts. And then general solicitation during the month of October each year. But as soon as you finish that particular campaign, you start planning for the next one. Now, you got to get pledge cards prepared and get addresses checked and everything that's necessary in a city of this size as to its geographical extension when you're making a so-called house-to-house solicitation. The records are just unbelievably large. I mean, it's voluminous records. And the checking and checking. Now, to take busy people and give them a name and address, even in businesses where they move from one building to another, and somebody makes a call and they get there and they find the wrong, they've come to the wrong address, they're not very happy about it. So they have to double check almost. And on all of these particular pledge cards, and you're bound to, in spite of all your efforts to occasionally make some mistake, people move sometime, you know, in 2 or 3 days' time, just pick up and move. Well, the outside of the campaign preparation, which is a year-round job, of course the collections are, billing is done every month. Anything as large as this, where you're talking about $2,300,000 plus, the pledges many people make are paid monthly. And so billing statements must go out, and again, you need to have the records in proper shape and get all these notices out for tax purposes and otherwise in order to make your collections. Another big job is the budgeting, and I mentioned about 60-some people on the budget committee, maybe a few or more or less each year, depending on who's setting it up and the campaign or budget chairman and the campaign chairman's wishes in the matter. But this is a time-consuming job because the records that they require covers all the salaries and all of the agencies by name. All the detail must be furnished, the certified public accountant's audit for each agency, and their program has to be described, what they put on. If there are any changes, they describe what they propose to do in the way of changes. If they want to add any more to the staff, they're required to notify the chest and get approval, because anytime you keep adding persons to the staff, why, the total budget goes up, and you can't get the budget too much out of line with what the actual giving results are, or it's just foolish to go out and try to raise $5 million when the most you can raise is $1 million, say, $400,000 or $500,000. So, that's what occupies the time, and of course it takes close supervision to keep these people busy on the jobs. It's set up like any business, and the auditors, the chest is audited by certified public accountants and so on, just like any business. And there's close supervision by an executive committee, so it's a the books are open, and it's I think a very fine, efficiently operated organization.
Let's go back to the very, very, very beginning. How did you, in particular, happen to get interested in this line of work, and how you got started with working with Community Chest?
Well, I served for many years as an official in a trust company, and making mortgage loans, many millions of dollars worth of mortgage loans, and writing insurance, and that as an official of the company. And there was a state senator of Indiana, a man that was district governor of the Rotary Club, and I knew him very well, and his son even better. And the executive in Gary, Indiana, where I came from, I don't believe I mentioned that city previously, in northern Indiana, right on Lake Michigan, industrial city, United States Steel Corporation has one plant there that when I was there employed in excess of 20,000 people, and they had three or four subsidiaries there, all of the United States Steel Corporation. This senator stopped me on the street one day, and he said, "Leonard," he said, "our chest executive is going to be leaving for a larger city. And he said, I'd like to see you put in an application to succeed him." Well, I kind of laughed at it at the time. I said, "Look, I'm not specially trained in that field." And he said, "Well, you've been working very closely." I said, "Yes, as a volunteer." I said, "I've been, for the past 5 years, I've been on the budget committee." And I said, "I've served for 4 years as chairman of the budget committee." I said, "I am close to the operation, but I said, you know, there's a lot more to it than just budgeting." And, I appreciate your interest and thank you very much, and I'll give a little consideration. I talked to some other people and they urged me to put in my application, and I did, and met to be interviewed, and I was faced with people from in town and out of town, and with master's degrees, and some of them from with professional training in fundraising, and so happened that I was chosen over the group. And so I served as the executive of that community chest in Gary, and also headed the Council of Social Agencies, the planning body for community welfare services there, both public and private agencies. So that's how I got in this field. And then I told previously about the call from Ed Moyer to invite me to come to Tulsa to look the situation over here. And we came, we looked, we saw, they saw us, and we stayed.
Why does it interest you to work as the executive director rather than as a volunteer while holding another position to support yourself?
I don't get your question, I don't believe that.
Why would you want to take this as your full-time work? What appeals to you about that position rather than working simply as a volunteer?
Well, as working as a volunteer, you're going back. Of course, the only time I've been a volunteer in church work all the years of my life, of course. Serving as the executive director of the chest, which is a full-time job, that wasn't a volunteer job.
No.
Oh, not the executive. That's 24 hours a day. People call me many times at night and Sundays and so on. That was my livelihood. The president and campaign chairman are volunteers and all of the workers, but somebody, I was the manager. I set up, I directed the staff and all. I was there all year round on the budgeting and sat through every hour of budgeting sessions and of the campaign. I think maybe I didn't make that clear to you, but no, the executive director is a paid position, full time, and so the volunteer work is upon my retirement, now. And when I served in Gary on the budget committee, that was volunteer work, but I was a banker at that time, as I said, making mortgage loans and handling the insurance and the trust business of a trust company as one of the officials. But I was doing the budgeting on the side, in addition, as a volunteer. But then I took on a full-time job as the executive of the Gary Community Chest and gave up the banking business.
Evidently, you didn't understand what I mean, and I didn't understand what you meant.
Now.
What I